everybody was talking about Jesus. I'm going to get you to think back to really 2,000 years ago. When Jesus began his ministry, everybody was talking about Jesus. And the big question was, is this man a prophet? Could he possibly be the Messiah? Now, it wasn't something new to be talking about the Messiah. If you consider from creation on, shortly after creation, God gave us a number of prophecies that said that there was a Messiah that was going to come. And by the way, on the screens, I have a habit of putting verses up that I don't have time to cover. So if you take notes and you want to mark down some of the extra passages, they're there. But if you look at that timeline of history just briefly, notice that you get towards the right-hand side just before what we said in the New Testament period, and there's a gap there called silence. There was almost 400 years that there had been no authenticated prophet anywhere in Israel. And in the midst of no authenticated prophet, everybody looked at that as being silence. God wasn't speaking to them anymore. 300 years before Jesus, in the middle of that period of silence, the Jewish teachers started to identify from scriptures what miracles the Messiah would do. They felt that if a prophet came on the scene, how would we know that this is not just an ordinary prophet, if you can say any prophet's ordinary, but how would we know that this is the Messiah? And so they started to look through what we call the Old Testament, what they called scriptures, and they started to look through that and say, what would identify him as being different than all the others? How would we recognize the Messiah? Bear with me, I've never used an apple anything before. The religious rulers and everyone knew that the Messiah would be the son of David. I mean, that was just, everybody knew that. That was Old Testament. That was in so many different passages. And by the way, it's something that comes up even at one point when Jesus was teaching. When the Pharisees were gathered together in Matthew 22, Jesus asked them a question saying, what do you think about the Christ? Whose son is he? And they said to him, the son of David. I mean, if you had asked that of anybody in Israel at that time, they would have immediately said, of course, the Christ, the Messiah, was going to be the son of David. Only the religious rulers had access to the temple registry. And at the temple registry, they actually kept track of genealogies, not only for the priests, but also for kings. And any of the religious rulers could check and see if somebody was of the line of David. So this wasn't something that the people were too concerned about. They figured, well, of course, that if someone's of the line of David, the rulers will know this. The rulers can check into this, and they'll tell us. So that wasn't really one of the things that anybody was even questioning. That was just forgotten conclusion that it was going to be somebody in the line of David. So when I say that they started to identify from scriptures the miracles, it was more specifically, what would this Messiah, the son of David, do that would make him stand out? How would we recognize him? So in that time of no authenticated prophets, this is after the time of Malachi, the last of the Old Testament, what we call the minor prophets, not because minor for what they wrote, but just because they were small books. And during that time, they started to identify passages, and we read already from Isaiah, but there's other passages in Isaiah, other chapters in Isaiah, and it was primarily from Isaiah that they took a number of passages and said, based on these, we believe that the Messiah will do four miracles that is different than any other prophet. In other words, not something that repeats what a prophet's done before, but something unique to the Messiah that no prophet ever before has done. So you have these four specific miracles, and then you have what you could call ordinary miracles. Doesn't that sound odd? There's no such thing as an ordinary miracle, right? I mean, a miracle is something where God is at work. And so there's no ordinary miracles. But they would say that the ordinary miracles, if you will, were the ones that other prophets had already done before. And by the way, the Jews had said after Malachi, after the minor prophets, that there was no authenticated prophet. And there's always this thought in Judaism that still exists today that says that that's done until the Messiah comes. And what the Jews of today still fail to recognize is that the Messiah has already come. And so, the first of those. So the first of all of the miracles that would stand out, the one that would be different than any prophet before, would be that the Messiah would be able to cleanse a leper. We think about leprosy for a moment. Leprosy is a disease that's still around today. The difference is that we have some medicines that can actually deal with it. But leprosy was really a death sentence back in ancient times. If you got leprosy, it was going to be a slow, painful death. And the law singled out, and when I say the law, the Old Testament law, the law of Moses, that law singled out leprosy in a unique way because there was many things that you could do that would end up making you unclean under the law. There was many things you could touch and that was going to make you unclean. But the only time the law has someone becoming unclean by touching a living body is in cases of leprosy. You touch somebody who's alive that has leprosy and you become unclean. So because of that, lepers were excluded from the community. They were outside. They didn't get to participate in what went on in the synagogue or at the temple, all of that. So Numbers chapter 19, if you want to read about that, that you're banished outside the camp for touching a dead body. But leprosy was like a living death, which meant that you're banished outside the camp forever and ever because you have leprosy and it continues on. The Jews actually looked at leprosy as something inflicted by God. And how do you get there that God would use leprosy as something that he could inflict on somebody? They often, even in ancient Jewish writings, called it the finger of God. Well, they looked to the Old Testament examples of leprosy, that God demonstrated his power a number of times using leprosy. Think about Moses himself. When Moses was even questioning what he was supposed to be doing, and God's telling him, you're going to be a spokesperson, that you're going to be the person that's out there leading the people out of slavery. In the midst of that, for a brief time in Exodus chapter 4, God struck Moses with leprosy and then immediately healed him. So again, it was felt to be something that showed the power of God because only God could give it and only God could take it away. So they held that the Messiah, acting on behalf of God, would be capable of curing a leper. Some of the other Old Testament accounts. Miriam, Moses' sister, she was afflicted with leprosy by God for opposing Moses, Numbers chapter 12. And again, she was healed of it after a time, again by God. And then another big one, King Uzziah. King Uzziah probably had one of the best reigns of all of the Old Testament kings. And it said that almost anything he put his hand to do, he was successful at it. And it went to his head. What's the next thing you find out Uzziah's doing? He's deciding that not only things that God has enabled him to do, but he wants to do things God has said that the priests are supposed to do. So he tries to go into the temple and do what the priests are supposed to do. What happens? God strikes him with leprosy. And in this case, he dies of that leprosy. It says that he's actually excluded. He doesn't even get to live in the primary palace anymore. He's in a house excluded, and he dies of leprosy. So again, it was shown to be the finger of God, something that God could strike somebody with and only God could heal from. Anybody cured of leprosy in the Old Testament? Yes, there was. You've got Naaman. He was a Syrian. He was a Gentile. And word comes to the king in Israel saying that he wants to be cured of leprosy. And what does he say? 2 Kings chapter 5, 7. He says, am I God to kill and make alive? Because the king's like, what? Only God can do this. If he's got leprosy, he's been smitten of God. Only God can heal him of that. But in that case, Elisha is enabled by God to heal him of leprosy. Are there other cases of people being healed of leprosy in the Old Testament? No. And in fact, it was based on that silence that the Jews had said that the Messiah would be capable of curing a Jew of leprosy. very specifically, a Jew of leprosy. What about the law? Did the law talk about what was to be done if somebody was cured? Yes, there was a whole procedure in the law. And that's something we're going to deal with a little bit more. But again, they're looking very specifically for the Messiah to cleanse a leper, and very specifically, a Jewish leper. There was lots of lepers around Israel at the time. I mean, just in what we're told in the Bible, it gives us an idea that leprosy was fairly common. So Jesus publicly cleansed multiple lepers. And by that, occasionally it was individual lepers, but at one point he heals a bunch of lepers all together, all at one time. And every time Jesus cured somebody of leprosy, he told them to present themselves to a priest and follow through with the tests that the law demanded. Because the law had built into it that said that if someone was cured of leprosy, they had to go through these tests to prove that they were now clear of leprosy. By the way, if you'd look at some of the passages I put on screen, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, that actually talks about Jesus healing lepers, there's possible other cases where Jesus healed lepers as well. For example, Jesus spends time at the home of Simon of Bethany. And when he's spending home time with somebody who was a leper, you don't visit a leper in their home if they still have leprosy. The implication there was that Jesus had cured him of leprosy before that. And then he spends time with him. But going to Luke chapter 17, verse 12, if you want to follow along, because this is one of the mass healings where Jesus healed a bunch of people of leprosy. Luke 17, verse 12. And as Jesus entered a village, he was met by 10 lepers who stood at a distance. Why'd they stand at a distance? Because remember, they were unclean, and anybody who gets to touch them is going to be considered unclean. And they stood at a distance and lifted up their voices, saying, Jesus, Master, have mercy on us. And when he saw them, he said to them, go and show yourselves to the priests. That sounds strange. He doesn't say anything about them being healed. He just says, go and show yourselves to the priests, which is saying, you've been cured. You may not recognize it yet, but you've been cured. Go and show yourself to the priest. Show that you've been cleared of leprosy. But remember, until Jesus started doing these healings of lepers, in all of the history of Israel, there had been never a case of a Jew being cured of leprosy. How many people would be talking about that? Everybody. So go and show yourselves to the priests. And as they went, they were cleansed. Then one of them, when he saw that he was healed, turned back, praising God with a loud voice, and he fell on his face at Jesus' feet, giving him thanks. Now he was a Samaritan, and Jesus answered, were not 10 cleansed? Where are the 9? Was no one found to return and give praise to God except this foreigner? I'm going to emphasize it again. Throughout all of Israel's history before Jesus' time, there are no accounts of anyone being declared free of leprosy under the law. Why is that significant? It implies that God included the test that would be before the priest, solely to confirm these messianic miracles. In other words, they had a way of proving that the Messiah did something unique that was different. I mean, remember Naaman the Syrian? Did anybody test his cure? I mean, God declares in scriptures that he was cured of it, but he never had to appear before a priest because he wasn't Jewish. He just goes back to his homeland, cured again, lives on his life. So the test was specifically there for the Jews to be able to recognize that it was the Messiah that was doing this, and this was something unique. And by the way, the test had built into it delays, so that the priests could only declare someone was free from their disease after they had gone through a number of things with each of the delays and ensured that there was true healing. The multiple sacrifices God included in the law for healing from leprosy revealed the severity of leprosy and the defilement it illustrates under his statutes. Consider this. There was a guilt offering, a sin offering, a burnt offering, the application of the blood of the guilt offering on the healed leper, and anointing with oil. And all of these were public. So that meant that people got to see that there was no doubt that this was a person that was once a leper that has now been cured of leprosy. It wasn't just some secret miracle. This was a miracle that everybody would know about. And because everybody knew about it, and it was being done before the priests, as I put in the big letters on the screen, every priest in Israel would have heard that Jesus had repeatedly healed leprous people. There wouldn't have been a priest anywhere. This would have been the thing that the priests would all be talking about, that this man has done something that is different than any prophet before. See, a lot of people think that, you know, Jesus was just a prophet. By the way, Islam teaches today Jesus is just a prophet, but Jesus was different than any of the prophets that came before. And very specifically, now in doing this with the lepers, he had done something that they said only the Messiah was going to do. So if you're doing checkbox and you got a list of things to say, you know, the Messiah, when he comes, he's going to do these things, you can now check off the first one. The Messiah was going to be capable of healing a leper, a Jewish leper. And Jesus didn't do it just once or twice. He did it a bunch of times. Everybody would have been talking about that. Okay, the second one. The second one is that the Messiah would be capable of casting out a deaf and mute spirit. That casting out a demon. I mean, people were demon-possessed. And it wasn't just an ordinary possession, because, I mean, look at the idea of even a person being possessed by a demon. What would casting out a deaf and mute spirit show? It would show God's power over individual sin and spiritual bondage, and that anybody who's doing this on behalf of God that could cast out a demon has to be enabled by God, because these are spiritual forces and only God has power over spiritual forces. Israel's religious leaders commonly cast out demons using a standard formula. So the priests in Israel could cast out demons, and they had a standard formula for doing it, where they spoke to the unclean spirit, gained a response, and discovered the demon's name. And then they commanded the demon to leave in the name of God. Okay, follow that, and you'll realize for obvious reasons, they deemed it was impossible to cast out any demonic spirit that resulted in the person being unable to hear and communicate. Couldn't hear what you were saying, it couldn't speak back to you, therefore they felt they had no ability to cast out that demon. So they said, the Messiah is the only one that could speak to a demon that couldn't hear. And again, these are things that they pulled from the book of Isaiah primarily. Jesus, by the way, at one time in scriptures, actually casts out a demon using almost the exact same procedure that was used by the religious rulers. And this was a case of when he was over on the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee, which was an area that was mostly Gentile, the Decapolis cities. And when Jesus was in that region, in Mark chapter 5, verse 6 to 13, the pagans from the nearby Decapolis region that came out to see this, they would have viewed Jesus' actions as that of the Israeli priests and the Pharisees that would do this. And yet Jesus still cast out demons a number of times. But then, he not only cast them out himself, he gave the authority to his disciples to do the same thing. Of course, that bothered the religious rulers because they thought that was something that was exclusive to them. So Jesus cast out many demons, and he gave authority to his disciples to do the same. And yet, it still wasn't the unique miracle that they were saying that only the Messiah could do. Because, I mean, of course, our religious rulers can do this as well. And then one notable case was brought to Jesus when his disciples could not do so. The passage was already read today, and this was a case of where they come to Jesus and they say, we asked your disciples to cast out this demon, and they couldn't do it. And this, again, was the specific case that the religious rulers taught was only possible by the Messiah. And here Jesus does this exact thing publicly in front of who? Not only his disciples, in front of the gathering crowd, And also it said that there was also scribes present. And the scribes were from the religious rulers. They were the people that were the ones looking for this as an identifying miracle for the Messiah. And Jesus spoke directly to the evil spirit and commanded it to depart. I mean, think about that. He spoke to a spirit that couldn't hear, theoretically, right? It was playing dumb, if you will. And, you know, you have no choice but to listen to the voice of God. And in Jesus speaking, this demon had no choice but to listen. Because there, he was listening to the voice of God, the Messiah. And Jesus stresses at the end of that passage to his disciples that this type took prayer. Why? Because its removal required God's verbal order. They needed to seek God's direct intervention to cast out this type of spirit. It wasn't just enough to speak to the spirit yourself. God needed to say, you need to leave. And in the person of Jesus, God was present as the Messiah. The witnessing scribes assured that the knowledge of this messianic miracle would have been widespread throughout Israel. So not only were they talking about what had gone on before, now they're talking about this second sign that said that the Messiah, only the Messiah could do this. You had, okay, check boxes again. Two boxes checked off to say only the Messiah is going to be capable of doing this. Did they immediately believe in him? No. And yet these were the things that they for 300 years have been saying. When we see these things, we'll know that the Messiah has come. And yet they weren't willing to listen to the testimony of the very things that they were now seeing with their own eyes. Third one. The third one is the healing of what we would call birth defects. And by the way, if you type in the words healing or birth defects into any of the new grammar checkers and things of that sort, it says this is politically incorrect wording. You're not allowed to use that wording. But what's it talking about? Something that would show God's power over humanity's inherited sin. And the Pharisees commonly believed that a parent's sins could cause birth defects in their child. And to a lesser degree, they sometimes felt that a child in the womb could be conceived with an inclination towards good and evil. And if it was evil, its actions in the womb could result in the baby being born with some physical problem. And even if that was the case, they kind of blamed the parents for having that evil baby. So who was being blamed for this when someone had birth defect? The parents, for the most part. And the child that was born with such an infirmity was considered to be a recipient of God's punishment. God is punishing that child. I mean, birth defects are a big thing. When you looked at the religious leaders, they viewed such defects as humanly irreversible conditions, a lifelong, endless punishment. They had a bunch of passages they used to try and justify that. I put some of them on screen. But I want to read at the bottom of what I have on screen is that the Jewish writings actually said how much they considered someone born blind to be inferior to someone who became blind. Catch that? Someone born blind was inferior to someone who became blind. In regards to synagogue practice, a blind person may repeat the Shema. The Shema was an act that the whole congregation did together as part of being in the synagogue. And you could act as a translator from Hebrew into Aramaic. But one who never beheld the light of the sun, moon, and stars, that is anybody who is born blind, may not repeat the Shema. In other words, if you were born blind, you were to be excluded, cast really as an outsider, to have nothing to do with everyday Judaism. Because they viewed you as being under perpetual punishment from God. And yet, birth defects. Jesus cured all illnesses. I mean, that says that in Matthew chapter 4, verse 23. He cured all illnesses, and he gave his disciples the authority to do the same. And you can be sure out of some of the things that he and his disciples were curing, that there was things that were genetic. I mean, I was born with a birth defect. I'm a hemophiliac. I'm a bleeder. I have defective DNA. And yet, that's the type of thing that Jesus healed. I mean, there was a woman who had an issue of bleeding. Jesus did that. And so over and over again, Jesus healed these types of things. But most of the people couldn't recognize some of those things as being birth defects. It needed to be something that was way over the top. And so Jesus healed a man born blind. I mean, that's a very obvious something that someone's born with when they can't see. And the entire account is found in John chapter 9, verses 1 to 38. And without taking the time to read the whole passage, I just want to do some highlights on this. In John chapter 9, verse 1, as Jesus passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Remember how everybody was thinking about this. It was primarily the parents' fault, but it could have been this guy in his womb, in the mother's womb. And Jesus answered, "It was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him." And then going to verse 6, "And having said these things, he spit on the ground and made mud with saliva. Then he anointed the man's eyes with mud and said to him, 'Go and wash in the pool of Siloam.' And so he went and washed and came back seeing." And verse 13, "They brought to the Pharisees the man who had formerly been blind. Now it was a Sabbath day when Jesus made the mud and opened his eyes. So the Pharisees again asked him how he'd received his sight. And he said to them, 'He put mud on my eyes and I washed and I see.' And some of the Pharisees said, 'This man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath.'" Look what they were overlooking. To say this was happening on the Sabbath, and we're just going to ignore the fact that this is one of the miracles that only the Messiah could do. In verse 18, "The Jews did not believe that he had been blind and received his sight until they called the parents of the man who had received his sight and asked, 'Is this your son who you say was born blind? How then does he now see?' And his parents answered, 'We know that this is our son and that he was born blind, but now he sees, and we do not know, nor do we know who opened his eyes. Ask him. He is of age. He will speak for himself.'" And it's noted right in the text. "His parents said these things because they feared the Jews, for the Jews had already agreed that if anyone should confess Jesus to be the Christ, he was to be put out of the synagogue." And verse 24. "So for the second time, they called the man who had been blind and said to him, 'Give glory to God. We know that this man is a sinner.' And the healed man answered, 'Whether he's a sinner, I do not know. One thing I know, that though I was blind, now I see.'" In verse 32, "Never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a man born blind." What was he saying? This is a miracle that has never been done before. "And if this man were not from God, he could do nothing." They answered him, "You were born in utter sin, and would you teach us?" And they cast him out. Now, your checklist. You got three things that they said only the Messiah could do, and Jesus has done them. And by the way, these are spread out through his ministry years. He didn't do them all at once. He spread them out. And again, word would just keep increasing. More and more people would be talking about. These are the signs that the religious rulers said that only the Messiah was going to be able to do these. And Jesus has now done three of them. How many are left? Only one. There was one more, but a little bit more on the man born blind. Jesus did that miracle shortly after the religious rulers wanted to stone him for blaspheming. And what were they saying that he was blaspheming? That he was saying that he was God or equal with God. And it's not blasphemy if it's true. And what does Jesus do right after that? He proves his divinity in this healing. He does something that the people said only God could ever do this because it was a punishment from God. And there he goes and does it. Again, it was done in the presence of many witnesses. This wasn't just some hidden or secret healing. This was done in the temple shadow. And it included a bunch of the religious rulers, so that the religious rulers, the ones that came up with this list, would see that he was the Messiah. This could not be the work of any what you call regular prophet, only God's Messiah or God himself. And again, in Jesus, it was both. He was the Messiah and God present in the flesh. I said there was one more. The fourth one, the fourth and last miracle that they said that only the Messiah could do, was raising the dead after 3 days. Now, you'd think it'd be a pretty good miracle if you raise the dead even after 1 day, right? I mean, how many of you can raise the dead? I mean, again, when we say ordinary miracles, there is no ordinary miracles. But think about raising the dead. It shows God's power to restore humanity's lost fellowship with God. I mean, it illustrates something that we are all born dying. And we look to our Savior to free us from this death. The corruption that accompanied death was considered a sign of death's permanency. In other words, when the body started to rot, this was guaranteed permanent. So they always looked at it in that fashion. And the religious rulers believed that a dead person's soul or spirit remained with the body for up to 3 days. And on this basis, after 3 days, when decay had begun, any type of revival or resurrection was impossible. Had there been anybody raised from the dead in Old Testament times? Yes, there was. There was a few cases where some of God's prophets were enabled to do something extraordinary. And you've got the case of the widow's son by Elijah. You've got the Shunammite's son by Elisha. And you have an unnamed person that was raised from the dead just from being put in with Elisha's bones. You know, the rabbis looked at those ones as being, if you will, freshly dead. All those people were raised to life the same day they died. Now, that's still a pretty amazing miracle, right? And they tended to forget, because in all of the Jewish writings that I could read, you never hear them talking about the whole thing about Ezekiel chapter 37, verses 1 to 10, the valley of dry bones. I mean, those are not freshly dead, but they're already to bones. That's been dead for a long time. That one never gets mentioned at all. So when they talk about the prophets raising someone to life, they looked at it being freshly dead. In other words, a regular prophet might be able to raise somebody who's only been dead for a day or two. But only the Messiah will ever be able to raise somebody that's been dead to the point where they're starting to decay. In other words, not freshly dead. Before I move on, if you're wondering what the box is on screen, in the time of Jesus, when you were buried, they would lay out the body, and the body would rot, and after the body had rot, they would sweep up all the bones, and they'd put it in a bone box, and they'd file the bone box. That's a first century bone box that's on screen. And so anybody who's in a bone box is not freshly dead. So did Jesus raise the dead? Yes, very early in his ministry, Jesus raised the dead. And he raised two dead people to restored physical life while simultaneously healing the cause of their death. And why do I say that? Because if Jesus raised you from the dead and he hasn't cured the cause of your death, you're going to just die again, right? So it's a simultaneous healing of whatever caused you to die and raising you back to life. And both of the people that Jesus earlier in his ministry raised to life were unquestionably dead, one with a crowd of mourners surrounding her at home and the other being carried to his grave. Many witnessed their death, and countless later could verify that these individuals were up walking around. It's a pretty good billboard to have somebody who was once dead walking around, right? They were healed, enjoying life. And worst of all, for Jerusalem's religious elite, the father of one of these people that Jesus raised to life was a respected ruler of the synagogue, a person whose testimony would bear significant weight. So if he's saying, my daughter was dead and is now alive, everybody's listening to that. And anybody who had heard about these freshly dead being raised to life would say there was no doubt Jesus was an amazing prophet. Because, again, that was something that, if you would say this way, a regular prophet could do. However, as I said, these people had only been dead for perhaps a half a day or a whole day. And I say only because, again, it's an amazing miracle when anybody who's dead is raised to life, whether it be a couple hours or 10 hours. But then something happens. Jesus raises the dead one well after 3 days. And just in brevity of time, you've got to read all of John chapter 11, and we just don't have the time to read it this morning. But the story, and you've probably heard it a number of times, is Jesus raises Lazarus of Bethany to life. Lazarus had had a lingering illness. And word is sent to Jesus. Jesus, where is he? Jesus and disciples are down away from Jerusalem. They're beyond Jericho, in a place Bethany beyond the Jordan in that region. And word gets to Jesus that says that Lazarus is dying. And what's everybody expect him to do? Immediately head there and heal him. What's Jesus choose to do? Not that. Jesus chose to wait before he goes. And he waits a couple days before he heads off. And then you have travel time. And by the time Jesus gets there, Lazarus is dead. Not just one day dead, 2 days dead, 3 days dead, 4 days dead. And why is that significant? Because remember, they taught that the spirit by that time, after 3 days, had definitely left the body, and there was no hope once decay had set in that anybody, no regular prophet, could ever raise someone to life that is 4 days dead. Done. Finished. And when Jesus shows up, what's he do? He speaks again to a dead man. And again, creation has to listen to its creator. And again, nobody questioned that Lazarus was dead. In fact, when Jesus says to open the grave, what's the first thing they say to him? By now he stinks. He was stinking dead. And Jesus speaks to a person that is stinking dead and says, come out. And what's he do? Well, think about who he's doing it in front of. Again, there's all the mourners there. This has got Lazarus' sister, Mary and Martha, that are there. All of these people that had seen what had happened leading up to his death and the illness that had caused him to die. And then they hear the Messiah do the last miracle of the four. By the way, this was in Jesus' timing. He waits to do this miracle until almost the very end of his period of earthly ministry. And why? Because he does it at a time that he knows that there's no question that he has then shown that he is the Messiah. No question. And you think, wouldn't they just automatically believe? No, they didn't. They chose not. But the religious rulers could not dismiss this testimony, because included in the crowd that saw Lazarus come out of the grave was some of the Jews, the religious rulers. That's listed in the crowd. They had witness of their own people. It was a large crowd of reliable witnesses that all heard Jesus say, Lazarus, come out. And a dead man comes out of the grave. At that point, as I said, they had no doubt that Jesus was the Messiah. The last of the four signs had been done. In John chapter 11, verse 47 to 48, so the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered the council and said, what are we to do? For this man performs many signs. Oh, that's an understatement. This man performs the signs, all four of the signs that they were waiting for the Messiah. And if we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. And then here was the real problem for them. And the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. They were more interested in power and wealth and prosperity and keeping their positions than they were in actually acknowledging God's Messiah that had come and had been authenticated by the very miracles that they were looking for. For fear of losing their power and offices, they were willing to ignore the clear and irrefutable evidence and follow through with their desires to see him dead. And it says, so from that day on, they made plans to put him to death. In the face of miracles like that, miracles that there was no doubt, how could you say this man is not the Messiah? And that they couldn't believe. out of all of this, the application for us is really summarized in John chapter 20, verse 30 to 31. Now, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. In other words, did Jesus do more miracles than what's recorded? Yeah. Yep, he did. But the ones that are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ. And when I say the Christ, it's the same word as Messiah. That he is the Messiah, the Christ, the promised one, the one that they were waiting, the one that they were looking for these special miracles. That these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is that one, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. All of this was written down with assurance that we have, that God provided eyewitness accounts and evidence sufficient for us to believe. And we need to be sharing this with others. Everything we need to share with other people. You say, well, I know people that don't believe. Then share God's word with them. That's what it's there for. These are the things that God said is necessary for people to believe. And every detail in the Bible is included for a reason. You know, these four special miracles that are just mentioned in the list of a whole lot of other miracles were there for a reason, that until you actually saw it in other Jewish writings that you realized that Jesus was intentionally doing the very signs that they said were only going to be the Messiah. And last of all, Jesus holds power over life and death. And I mean, if our Savior holds power over life and death and any physical infirmities, whether genetic or acquired, and for that matter, wicked spiritual forces, the demons that he cast out, as believers in him, what do we have to fear? Absolutely nothing. And that's one of the things that everybody who spent time with Jesus, his disciples, had to learn the hard way. There's nothing to fear when you're a follower of Jesus Christ. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, even as we looked into your word, and just over and over again, Father, our prayer needs to be, show us Christ. Lord, that each and every one of us would hunger for your word, to hide it in our hearts that we would not sin against you. Lord, just continue to teach us from your word. Father, help us to fix our eyes on Jesus, because he's the author and perfecter of our faith. And Lord, in that knowing that everything that people need to be able to believe is written in your word, Father, that we would take your word to a world that is lost. Father, for they need to hear these words, because they are life. Thank you for your goodness.